It's very hard to go to people and say, give a few dollars for Allah's work. They feel they're doing a big thing for Allah. And in their minds, Surah Yasin mentions that, I'll talk about it some other time. In their minds they're saying, why does God want me to contribute when He's so rich He can contribute Himself? Look at this notion. So we have strings attached. When we give charity and we make people feel bad.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
The indigenous people of Suriname amount to 20,344 individuals, about 3.8% of the country's population. The four most populated indigenous towns of Suriname are Kalinia and Locono, known as the lowland communities, and Trio, Wayano, and some other Amazonians who live in the south and are known as the highland people. During the time of the Dutch colony in the 17th century, the Native American local population of the area retreated back into the Amazon basin. 54,000 African slaves were sold in Paramaribo, the capital of Suriname, to work on sugarcane plantation in inhumane conditions, which caused many of them to flee into the forest. Suriname is one of the few countries in South America that has not yet ratified the Convention 169 of the International Labour Organization concerning the indigenous and tribal peoples. The country's legislation does not yet recognize indigenous communities, nor are there laws about their land ownership. Given the great profitability in natural resources exploitation and the biodiversity of the territory, this lack of a proper set of laws poses a direct threat to the existence of Native Americans of the region. 80% of Suriname is made up of primary tropical forests. The government has granted 40% of the lands to the fishing industry and the extraction and export of oil, bauxite, gold, and water.
If they're talking about development, it should benefit the group, you know, who lives in the interior. As I said, you can't talk about development if I'm not in the process. If I'm not a part, you know, of the process, if I'm not part of the management. I have to give you my own perspective, give you my experience, because it will affects and has impact on my life. So it's not that we are against, but we want to be a part and we want to share benefits of all those projects.
In the district of Guanica, the community of Pikimpoika is subject to a double threat. The advances of ecotourism, which led to the decision of constructing a highway through the village, and an agricultural project that involves deforestation. Thanks to the strong protests of the village chief, the highway construction has been stopped, but the agricultural project is still moving forward, and in the absence of a protective legislation for the indigenous people of Suriname, the local community is left without legal options to defend the territory.
Thank you.
For years, the state of Suriname granted property deeds to non-indigenous individuals, as well as licenses to mining companies, permitting them to operate in the region without consulting with the indigenous community and without obtaining their consent. In the 60s, the American aluminum company Alcoa built a hydroelectric power plant on the Suriname River to supply power to its subsidiary, Suralco. In order to complete the project, Alcoa flooded 50,000 kilometers of forest, which included 43 villages of the Samaka community. As a result, 6,000 people were displaced and had to be relocated in migratory camps. Most of the indigenous people are deprived of electricity to this date.
It benefits only the multinationals because I think more than 80% of all those energy is going to the multinationals like Alcoa, Suralco, and now we have IAMGOLD. So I think it's not benefits the local people, nor the people who were displaced at that period.
Okay, my name is Guillermo Walker. I'm from Coffee Camp. About the history of Coffee Camp Coffee Camp was formed before in the lake they call from Bloemfontein's Tjumeer. There was before, and they moved us because of the water. I don't know what it was, but they moved us from there and put us in Coffee Camp. Now the village name is New Coffee Camp because we are removed. It was like someone shoot you, you know. They won't give you life. I mean, it's not nice because our Maroon peoples have a tradition. When you live here, people of you die here. You want to stay there and live with your people until the end of time. You don't want to move and go and live somewhere else. Then it'd be like you lost your, your immune.
Your heritage?
Yeah. So, we want to live there with the people together and die with them together. That's it.
The increase in the price of gold makes Suriname a major exporter of this mineral, but extracting and processing gold leads to deforestation and the pollution of water. Therefore, the forests disappear and the natives are left without water. In small-scale or informal mining, mercury is used to process gold, and in large-scale mining, the companies use cyanide nitrate. The remains of this illegal substance stay in the water, polluting it for years.
Basically, you have two levels of mining. One is the large-scale mining done by incorporated companies, many of them multinationals. They tend to be more mechanized, have more advanced technology, better efficiencies, and it will often use a cyanide process.
Every year, 60 tons of mercury are discharged into Suriname's rivers because of informal mining. In the community of Apatina, blood tests were run and hair samples were taken to determine the level of mercury in the inhabitants' bodies. According to the results of the analysis, 109 members of Apatina tribe showed great contamination in blood due to the ingestion of mercury. The state of Suriname exploited three natural reserves within the territories of Kalania and Locono, which belong to the indigenous people of the Lower Marowijne, the most important estuary in the region. In 2015, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights voted in favor of the Kalania and Locono people, demanding the state of Suriname to protect their rights by recognizing the collective legal personality of both communities as well as their collective property ownership rights.
I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Sarah Augustine. I'm the co-director of the Suriname Indigenous Health Fund. Our next point is on the health effects of mercury contamination associated with dumping mine waste. Mercury bioaccumulates in fish, which is the primary source of protein. We've demonstrated in the risk assessment that we've submitted to the commission, which was published in 2012. This research demonstrates the risk that is imposed on the community of Apatina as a result from having a contaminated food supply. We demonstrated neurological impact, including a surge in birth defects, sickness, disability, and premature death in our health assessment, which we've also submitted to the commission. That was rooted for peer review in 2013. We've noted that bacteria and E. coli is in the water from high concentrations of itinerant gold miners, those gold miners are operating with inadequate sanitation, so they're polluting the sole water supply for the Wayana people. This is particularly important for children under age 5 who are impacted by diarrhea and dehydration. The impact of mercury is also specifically harsh on the youngest and most vulnerable population. Women who are pregnant are most severely impacted by mercury intoxication, as well as children under 5, those people whose nervous systems are still developing. We have also demonstrated in our health assessments that all individuals of all ages, are actually impacted by mercury contamination from this waste, inadequate dumping of toxic waste. We understand from the testimony of our in-country partners that concession owners willingly and knowingly support small-scale gold mining. This is important to note because often in the news you will hear that these are illegal miners that come into Suriname lands and there's no way to control that. But actually we are told that those people who control concessions in the interior are benefiting from that gold mining and are in partnership with these itinerant miners who come in and do this alluvial gold mining. Would like to ask the commission to encourage the state to regulate the gold mining industry and prohibit mercury pollution.
Despite the court's ruling, land concessions in Suriname continue. Another example is the planned expansion of Johan Adolf Pengel International Airport. The project involves issuing a land title which covers the traditional territory of at least 2 indigenous tribes, the Witsanti and Hollands Camp. 2 of the Witsanti leaders were brutally arrested after they prevented airport workers from taking technical measures necessary for the expansion in their village. After the arrest, the villagers erupted in protest and the residents of the area blocked the road to the airport, which resulted in the release of the leaders. The subsequent dialogue with the government has not yet produced any solution. In a previous ruling on the Saramaka case in 2007, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights decided that the states are obliged not only to consult with the indigenous communities according to their customs and traditions, but also to obtain their free, prior, and informed consent with regards to development or investment projects that may affect their territory. It was also established that the governments must reasonably share the benefits of such projects with the Saramaka people. Due to the constant repetition of violations against the rights of native people of Suriname, the court also ruled similar measures to be taken for all the indigenous tribes of the country. It also ordered the state to repair the serious damages caused by the bauxite extraction carried out by the Alcoa and BHP Billiton subsidiaries.
There should be social studies, you know, what's the effects and the impacts of those projects. Also, what will they gain out of those projects? If they're gonna get benefits, and what is the benefits? Because not only promises, but they have to be sure that it will give them work, you know, it will give them school, it will give them good healthcare. So we want to be a part of all those activities that the government and other third parties are planning to do and to have in our territory, in our communities, that will affect and that will have impact on our lives.
Following the decision of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, there is hope that Suriname would adopt its own legislation in defense of the territories and other rights of indigenous people, especially now when the interest in biodiverse territories and resources such as bauxite, gold, water, and forests is growing.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
خستگی واقعی و کسالت واقعی باز دو جوره.
The real tiredness and religious laziness is of two types. One type is called qabz,
which is the temporary type of tiredness. In such a situation, you feel downcast and low-spirited. Now, this type is very much different from the long-term tiredness.
کسالت ها و بیحالی ها گاهی ما ماندگار و پایدار گاهی ما موقته که حالا بازم الان خدمت رو توضیحشو میدم.
Feeling tired and downcast in terms of religion are sometimes stable and some other times temporary. If a religious scholar does not know the difference between the two, he will prescribe the same remedy for both spiritual problems. One such wrong prescription is leaving the recommended deeds and doing only the obligatory ones. This might be a remedy, but it is not the right solution to many spiritual problems. In better words, recognizing the true type of spiritual tiredness is very important. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRib English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. today's lesson, the peak of desires and extreme limit of aspirations. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to this show, everyone. You're listening to A to Z program. Now, in today's program, we're talking about the peak of desires in a human being and extreme limit of aspirations. A man's innate desires extends to infinity. There's no limit or boundary to any of these desires. They do not require restriction or even halt at a particular level. On the contrary, they all lead man to the ultimate point and making him having boundless desires. Now, having boundless desires is verily one of the characteristics of man or of a human being. Temporary and limited access does not content man. Even the non-religious philosophers do not deny man's innate desires. Rather, this is regarded as one of the most important principal differences of man and animals. Russell has noted as below, one of the most important principal differences of man and animals is that human desires, as opposed to those of animals, are boundless and cannot be fully materialized. There's no way they can be, you know, fixed. There's no way they can be fully materialized. Although these wishes are variegated, they are all finally brought together and their ultimate satisfaction is summed up in one thing: relationship with the infinite source of knowledge, power, beauty, and perfection. It is the future of the states of being that the more severe and the more powerful and perfect they become, the more they incline towards unity and extension.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to A to Z program. We're talking about the peak of desires and the extreme limit of aspirations in a man. Human faculties, which are dispersed when belonging to the body, are united when attached to the soul. While possessed of unity and extension, the soul embraces all human powers. In like manner, the extreme point of each of the innate desires, which extends to infinity and which is then united with other desires, is in fact one ultimate desire perceived from various viewpoints and angles. And that is dependence on a perfect infinite being. That is to say, proximity to the Almighty Allah in such a state makes a man realize his complete relationship with the Creator. He sees himself dependent on and linked to Him, or rather, he sees himself as the incarnation of dependence on and relationship with Him. Before His presence, man observes no independence for himself. In this state, he sees all objects dependent on the Holy Divine Being and acquires speculative knowledge of the realities of existence. On the basis of his own existential involvement, he reaps benefit from rays of divine grandeur and beauty. The man's innate desire to recognize the realities of existence is materialized. Now, in this state, man finds a way to the source of infinite power. By being related to this source, man obtains the power to perform whatever he wills and wishes.
in the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has backed his close ally Dominic Raab in relation to a series of claims that Raab mistreated civil servants. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Sun has more for us. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has backed his close ally Dominic Raab after he faced a series of claims he mistreated civil servants. The Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab is under pressure after it emerged that staff within the Ministry of Justice were offered a route out of the department when he was reinstated. Mr. Raab was also forced to defend himself after insiders claimed he angrily threw tomatoes from a pret-a-manger salad across a meeting room, as he wasn't pleased with the way he was being briefed. However, Rishi Sunak said, "I don't recognise that characterisation of Dominic, and I'm not aware of any formal complaints about him." Of course, there are established procedures for civil servants if they want to bring to light any issues. I'm not aware of any formal complaint about Dominic. Mr. Raab will be in full glare of the public spotlight this week, as he steps in for Rishi Sunak at Wednesday's Prime Minister's Question Time. He's expected to face off against Angela Rayner in the House of Commons showdown. Civil servants had described his behaviour during a previous stint in the department as demeaning, rude, and one person even branded him a bully. Justice Secretary Mr. Raab was even nicknamed the incinerator as he burns through staff so quickly. The comments come as eight people coming in Mr. Raab's office while he was Foreign Secretary claimed to have been bullied or harassed at work, according to a leaked survey. The poll, which was carried out in late 2019, also revealed that 15 staff members reported witnessing another person being bullied or treated unfairly. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak added, "My understanding is that these surveys are annual and relate to the overall work environment and not to individuals." Tory MPs have defended Dominic Raab in recent days, including Eddie Hughes, who said he was hardworking and expected high standards from others. The British newspaper The London Evening Standard has also covered the same story. Rishi Sunak has come out in defence of Dominic Raab after the Deputy Prime Minister was accused of rude and demeaning behaviour towards civil servants. The Prime Minister said he did not recognise that characterisation of his deputy and denied knowing about any formal complaints against him. Mr. Sunak is facing further questions over his judgment as allegations of bullying emerge from Mr. Raab's previous stint as Justice Secretary, with staff reportedly offered a route out of his department when he was reinstated in October. The Prime Minister told reporters travelling with him to Indonesia for the G20 summit, he said, "I don't recognise that characterisation of Dominic and I'm not aware of any formal complaints about him." Of course, there are established procedures for civil servants if they want to bring to light any issues. I'm not aware of any formal complaint about Dominic. Dominic Raab is expected to stand in for his party leader during Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday. Downing Street said the Prime Minister believed that people in public life should treat others with consideration and respect. A number 10 Downing Street spokeswoman said, "While they were not aware of any formal complaint concerning Mr. Raab, there were procedures available to civil servants if they had concerns. There are established procedures by which civil servants can raise complaints. These processes allow allegations to be looked at and considered with due process and a fair hearing," the spokeswoman said. A survey of 20 people working in Dominic Raab's private office when he was Foreign Secretary in 2019 showed that 40% reported personal experience of bullying and harassment, though not necessarily by Mr. Raab, and 75% witnessed it, according to an ITV report on Sunday. The website of French newspaper Le Monde has also covered the same story. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak faced new questions on Saturday, 12th of November, over his choice of senior officials after his number two was accused of behaving aggressively towards staff. The controversy over Dominic Raab, who is Deputy Prime Minister and Justice Secretary, came after fellow Sunak ally Gavin Williamson was forced out of the new government because of alleged bullying. Dominic Raab, Rishi Sunak's most vocal supporter in the summer Conservative leadership race against Liz Truss, was brought back into the cabinet when Ms. Truss was forced out as Prime Minister after just 6 weeks in office. Rishi Sunak restored him to his previous role of Justice Secretary, where he had presided over a culture of fear, according to the Guardian newspaper. Some 15 senior civil servants at the ministry were offered a route out to different government jobs if they felt unable to serve under Dominic Raab because of his past behaviour, it said. The Sun newspaper, meanwhile, reported that Mr. Raab had once hurled tomatoes from a salad across a room in a fit of anger during a meeting, which a spokesman for the minister said was nonsense. More generally, the spokesman said, Dominic Raab has high standards, works hard and expects a lot from his team as well as himself. He has worked well with officials to drive the government's agenda across Whitehall in multiple government departments and always acts with utmost professionalism. Rishi Sunak was already under fire for reappointing Gavin Williamson to a ministerial role despite being told he was under investigation for allegedly bullying another senior Conservative. The Prime Minister also faced criticism for reinstating Suella Braverman as Interior Minister just 6 days after she was forced to quit the Liz Truss cabinet over a security breach. The opposition Labour Party pointed to those controversies as it termed the latest accusations deeply troubling, demanding that Prime Minister Sunak launch an inquiry. With each new scandal and grubby deal, it becomes more obvious that he's a weak leader who puts party management before the national interest, Labour Party's deputy leader, Angela Rayner, has emphasised.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly, I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly, she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the laws or religious laws related to business according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mama Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the religious laws or Islamic laws related to business according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Sheikh Javid, I'm going to ask you this question. You know, what is the Islamic law about the money which is earned, the income made from selling haram foodstuff, you know, in a cooperative, in a big, for example, place, especially when it is destined to be distributed among the shareholders?
The income, okay. Well, it is not permissible to sell or offer, you know, intoxicants to a client.
Yes.
You know, alcohol or wine or things like that. In that, the answer given by the religious authorities is very clear, and I think all the Shia scholars are unanimous when it comes to selling haram things like intoxicants, wine and alcohol is absolutely forbidden, and it's not permissible to do anything concerning intoxicants. And when it comes to pork, of course, the position is also clear. The religious authorities, including His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei, are of the view that, of course, selling and buying pork are not permissible as a measure of precaution, because he has exercised precaution and when it comes to selling or buying pork, of course. And he says that it's not permissible to distribute the proceeds among shareholders, the proceeds of the pork, you know, that's something, because pork is essentially impure, and something which is essentially impure cannot be sold and cannot be possessed, cannot be distributed among other people. Even the proceeds cannot be distributed as a measure of precaution, and this is what His Eminence says. Of course, this is the position declared by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei when it comes to pork, and also when it comes to meat, which is forbidden and which is haram to consume.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Sher Shavid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, host in this program, and Sheikh Chobid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the religious laws about business. Well, Sheikh Chobid, you know, we know that a lot of people work in the hotel industry, you know?
Yes, of course.
And just along with the non-Muslims in the non-Muslim countries or non-Islamic dominated countries, you know? So, related to or as given the norms of social behavior in those countries, the owner has to serve many other things which are not considered to be halal by the Muslims or the Islamic Sharia law, right? Like alcoholic drinks, for example, or yes, other food stuff, as we know. Well, so some of them might be haram, like the pork, as you know, all right? Or as yes, you mentioned in the previous question.
Yes.
To the customers. So they have to serve it, in fact, to whoever, you know, comes to the hotel or to the restaurants, for example, of the hotel.
Yes.
So otherwise, they will not go to their hotel. If they don't do it, if they don't give that service, right, to the customers, the yeah, customers would not rate it, for example, a high rank hotel, and then they will refuse to go there, and they will go to the other hotel, so they will end up losing their industry at sure, the end of the day, right? So it is also to be noted that the businessman, if, well, we propose or we suppose that the business person is Muslim, intends to dispose of all the profit made on the haram food given in the hotel, in the relevant hotel, right? And drink the haram food and drink, and by giving it to a hakim shar, for example, is it permissible for him to do so, to stay in that business?
Again, I have to further explain the answer I gave in the previous question, as part of the answers to the previous question. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, there is no problem in doing business as a hotelier, or as someone who serves, or as a server, or as a waiter, or as the, let's say, the manager of a merchandise or a hotel or restaurant, you know, in non-Muslim countries, it is permissible. But of course, it's not permissible to sell or offer, you know, people intoxicants. That's the main point. You may run a hotel or let's say a coffee shop or something like that in a non-Muslim country, but what is extremely and of course without any doubt forbidden is the sale and purchase of intoxicants. And one should not offer such things also, even if he possesses in his stock such things. First of all, he should destroy them, he should not sell them. And if he wishes to offer, he should understand that it's haram, and mm-hmm. he cannot possess or take ownership of the proceeds mm-hmm. of those intoxicants. And as I said, as in a hotel, you're not going to serve or sell intoxicants only. Intoxicants is a part of one of these many things that may be given or served or offered to the clients. The main thing that people come to the hotel for is food, okay?
Except that it's not the pork or the other stuff.
Yeah, when it comes to pork, of course, the religious authorities have exercised precaution mm-hmm. and they say that it's not permissible as a measure of precaution to sell pork. I think since we have discussed it in the previous episode as well, pork is something which is considered to be impure. An impure thing cannot be sold. Like, for example, you cannot sell something like filthy objects mm-hmm. to people and take money for it. Filthy objects cannot be sold, cannot be, distributed, and cannot be given to someone as a gift or something like that. Now, if you want to have, for example, if someone gives you a gift of a bottle of alcohol.
You mean the trade is in and of itself haram and annulled?
Yeah, and of course it is.
Or false.
It is invalid in the first place.
Yes.
Now, because I have come to across people who ask questions, they said, okay, someone has given me a bottle of alcohol as a gift. What should I do? Should I give it to someone, to a non-Muslim or not? Should I just throw it away?
Right.
The answer is clear. He should throw it away. He cannot gift it to a non-Muslim, even if that may come as a very good thing for that non-Muslim, okay? Mm-hmm. He cannot sell it, he cannot gift it, and he cannot receive money for it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.